John got a reputation for making GOP miracles happen in blue states. He was approached by Republicans from around the country who wanted help with House and Senate runs. By 39, he was one of the highest-paid consultants in the business. It wasn't Wall Street money, but it was more than he had ever made before. It only got better when the governor decided to run for president, putting them both on a national stage. Once John had had to sell the guy to Massachusetts as a Republican who leaned left on social issues. Now, he was the Irish Catholic who traveled the country putting religious right-wingers at ease about the Mormonism, the liberal positions on gay marriage and abortion. John's presence, his very name, seemed to say that he wouldn't stand behind someone who wasn't just as conservative as they were. John changed their minds. He got five former ambassadors to the Vatican to back his guy publicly over two Catholic rivals ahead of the New Hampshire primary. It felt good to be useful. In the end, the governor was the party's runner-up for the highest office in the nation. They were already laying the groundwork for a 2012 run. John had a staff of 15 people. Gorgeous, massive offices in Government Center. Most of his revenue came from lobbying now, and a growing list of corporate clients. He knew there were those who said it was all one big conflict of interest, but he didn't let it bother him. His only regret was that his father hadn't lived long enough to see him reach the top. If he ever felt a twinge of doubt, he'd write a big check to Bridget's dog shelter or to the Home for Little Wanderers. John couldn't stop now, even if he wanted to. Julia had grown up with money. When they were young and had none, she swore it didn't matter. But the better they both did, the more extravagant her tastes became. Her handbag from some no-name boutique was no longer good enough. She needed Chanel. They got upgraded to first class on one flight, and afterward, Coach seemed like an unfathomable nightmare. They sent Maeve to private school and horseback riding lessons. She'd been getting $100 haircuts on Newbury Street since she was 9. They had a beach house now. Both houses had to be decorated with antiques, where once mass-produced crate and barrel stuff had sufficed. Meanwhile, his mother thought even Crate and Barrel was a hideous ripoff. "I have lots of nice pieces in the cellar. You should take a look," she said to Julia whenever Julia told her they had gotten something new, which was often. She had a habit of changing her mind about furniture, casting off perfectly good things to his sister or a neighbor down the block. To Julia's credit, she had come to understand that his mother didn't appreciate aesthetics, only a bargain. When Nora asked where they'd gotten a $10,000 Georgian campaign desk, Julia said, without blinking, that she'd bought it at Pottery Barn. He sometimes thought that if his mother saw his credit card bills, his mortgage, she might lose the power of speech. John was spending every penny he earned, saving next to nothing. It was the opposite of what he'd been raised to do. He named his company Milltown Strategies, after his parents' hometown, an homage to the American immigrant story. His mother was not impressed. "People won't know how to spell it, John. Nobody's ever heard of that place. You should call it something catchier." Nothing he could do was ever good enough for Nora. Sometimes it seemed like she had barely registered John's existence, even if, as his wife liked to remind him, His entire life had been shaped by the quest for her approval. His stock had only gone up when he gave her a grandchild. She was far more proud of Patrick's bar than of anything John had done. It had always been Pat's big dream to open a place of his own on Dorchester Avenue, because one more dive bar was just what Dorchester needed. He talked about it all the time back when he was working on the loading dock at the Conley Terminal in Southie, loading and unloading shipping containers. They were filled with seafood one day, beer the next, scrap metal after that. It seemed like the bar idea would never go any further than fantasy, until Patrick caught what he referred to as his big break. While he was working, a line snapped. A crate fell to the ground, severing two of his toes. Had Patrick been a couple of inches farther to the left, it might have taken off his whole foot. A few inches farther than that, and he would have been a dead man. But painful though it was, he could live without a couple of toes, especially when he was awarded 200 grand for his troubles. Pat used the money to open the bar. Nora acted like it was some great accomplishment when Pat had only gotten his wish because of a stupid lawsuit. He wasn't paying attention. He was probably drunk on the job. Now he had his best friend and his little brother running the bar, Fergie and Brian, the dream team. The black town car pulled up right on time. John saw the driver make a move to get out and open the door for him. He gestured for the guy to stay where he was.
"I've got it," he said.
He slid into the warm back seat.
"How's it going, buddy?"
The driver just nodded in reply. John saw himself through this guy's eyes and felt the need to say something. Whenever he hired anyone to do some menial job, he had a pathological desire to let that person know that the two of them weren't so different, that John was well aware of it.
"My Uncle Lawrence used to drive a bus," he thought of saying. "Then later he became a chauffeur. Did he ever have crazy stories? I bet you've had some colorful characters sitting back here. Am I right?"
There were two small bottles of water tucked into the seat back pocket. He took hold of one instead of speaking, unscrewed the cap. His phone rang again.
"My mother," he said to the driver.
John picked up, prepared for her to say that she had seen his name in the paper, prepared to downplay his own pride now that he had hers.
"Where have you been?" Nora said. She sounded frazzled. "I've been trying and trying, you and Bridget both, and Julia. It just rings. There's been an accident, John."
"Oh, God, are you okay?"
"Not me," she said. "Patrick."
He stiffened.
"Is he okay?"
"John, he's dead."
"Go back," John said to the driver before he replied. "Turn the car around."
Chapter 8. Bridget didn't notice that her mother had called that morning because she was in bed with Natalie, and then walking the dog with Natalie, stopping for coffee along the way. She brushed her teeth at the sink while Natalie showered and lingered in the bathroom as it filled with steam, carrying on a conversation about Natalie's boss, taking in the clean, soapy scent of her shampoo, pulling back the curtain for a kiss. They ate Greek yogurt and strawberries in the kitchen. In the background, a BBC reporter's silvery accent told of atrocities in faraway places they might or might not be able to locate on a map. Bridget was dressed for the day in jeans, sneakers, a navy blue crewneck sweater, the same uniform she'd been wearing since the second grade.
Natalie wore black high-heeled boots that ended just below the knee, a fitted gray dress, and a long black coat open over the top. Red lipstick, a gauzy silk scarf. Her red hair hung to her shoulders. They looked always like characters in two different plays. When they went out on a Saturday night, Bridget spent 10-15 minutes max ironing a shirt, running a comb through her short brown hair. She would be dressed and on the couch with enough time to watch 4 innings of baseball before Natalie was ready to go. They said their goodbyes at the door now.
Love you.
See you tonight. After Natalie was gone, Bridget drank one more cup of coffee alone. Sunlight flooded the windows and the hardwood floors, giving the illusion that it wasn't bone cold outside. The apartment had been Natalie's first. She went with the place. Bridget saw her in the careful details. Framed abstract watercolors on the walls, purchased from a friend with a gallery in Williamsburg. Different ceramic bowls in the cupboards for pasta, yogurt, cereal. A larger bowl at the center of the kitchen table with nothing in it, strictly decorative. A pair of antique brass bookends shaped like hound dogs sat on the mantel, a gift from Natalie to Bridget on the occasion of the shelter's 10th anniversary. Until she moved in 3 years ago, Bridget had lived like a bachelor. Her brothers joked that she had taken a vow of poverty. She didn't care much about things. She had nicer-than-expected mismatched furniture, passed along whenever her sister-in-law redecorated. But her prized possessions were an old Trek bicycle, 2 milk crates full of records, and every Celtics game of the 1986 season recorded on VHS. Her life then had consisted of a date here and there, a short-lived love affair once in a while, visits to her mother in Boston at the holidays, work mostly. At home, it was just Bridget and Rocco, an aging pit bull, together in a dim apartment, content to be a couple of old grumps forever, until Natalie came along and let in the light. She tried now to picture a high chair at the end of the table, a baby's toys strewn across the rug, a time when leisurely mornings like this one would be a thing of the past. In advance of her 35th birthday, Natalie had announced that the gift she wanted most was not jewelry or tickets to a Broadway show, but a baby. Bridget had never thought of herself as particularly maternal. She couldn't muster much enthusiasm for baby pictures, or for the fact that one more human being had learned to correctly identify the letter D. When she thought about motherhood, she thought of her own mother and her aunts, who, when she was young, liked to sit around on someone's front porch on summer nights, playing cards, smoking and drinking Canadian Club. They had always seemed a bit bored, dissatisfied by their children. Yet later, all they spoke about was the desire for grandkids. They had sacrificed everything. The least their daughters could do to pay them back was to suffer in a similar fashion. Bridget still wasn't entirely convinced, but she believed that Natalie deserved to be a mother if that's what she wanted. And, to her surprise, at 44, she found that the idea of having a baby with Natalie excited her at least as much as it terrified her. A year had passed since Natalie first raised the issue. It sometimes felt like, since then, they had spoken of nothing else. Bridget thought they might consider adopting, like her brother John had. But Natalie had given it far more thought. She explained to Bridget that gay couples were banned from adopting from most foreign countries and several states. And anyway, she wanted a child who shared her blood. She wanted to give birth, for reasons Bridget could not fathom. Natalie knew which baby names she liked, and she had found a top-rated clinic where she would be inseminated. They had chosen a donor, though they had yet to actually purchase his sperm. They called him by his official profile name, International Archaeologist. He was 5'11", 175 pounds, with blonde hair and blue eyes. Hobbies: the Brazilian martial art of capoeira. Running 22 miles per week. Ancestry: Swedish. Donor look-alike: Paul Bettany, Paul Newman. But those two look nothing alike, Bridget said. Personality: his positive outlook is contagious. Bridget wondered what was to stop the sperm bank from telling them all this when, in fact, the guy was a short, depressive high school dropout who worked at Burger King. She kept the thought to herself. It had taken them months to decide. Night after night, they lay in bed, scrolling through profiles. You could go by any attribute, eye color, blood type, even the sound of a man's voice recorded in short audio clips, or the age of his oldest living relative. They grew drunk with choosiness. He has to have gotten at least a 1480 on the SATs, Natalie said once. You realize if you'd used that criterion to find a partner, I'd be out, Bridget said. By a lot. Good golfer, Natalie declared at some point, and at another. Disqualified, his favorite animal is the cat. Bridget refused to shortlist anyone with a sleazy profile name. There was a So Smooth, a Dr. Feel Good. One was called I'll Just Have Water. Translation, alcoholic, she said. She wondered what compelled a young man to take this particular route to making extra cash. How many of them would think about it differently in 10 or 15 years? One night, she lay awake thinking about her youngest brother, Brian. All the debt he'd racked up in his 20s following a dream that didn't pan out, living on the road for so much of every year, and now living at home with their mother because, she assumed, he was broke. She texted him, If you ever need a few extra bucks, ask me, okay? Don't do anything stupid. Brian just replied, ? When they finally settled on a donor, Natalie's credit card in her hand, fingers poised over the keyboard to make the purchase, Bridget panicked. Though it should have been obvious much sooner, that was the first time she realized she would have to tell her mother. Her brain tried to find a way around it. She pictured herself arriving home at Christmas with an infant in a carrier. Whose baby is that, Bridget? Who, him? Oh, never mind. Before we buy the sperm, I feel like I should warn my mother that this is coming, she said. Natalie, whose parents had known for ages, blinked. Oh, okay. 3 months had gone by, and still Bridget had not done it. A few weeks ago, when they were home for Christmas, she tried. Natalie and Julia planned a lunch at the Four Seasons, making the whole thing seem like Bridget's idea. But it was their kind of place, not hers. When Bridget invited her mother, Nora seemed skeptical. Just the two of us? Why on earth would we go there? I want to do something nice for you, that's all. Neither of them was comfortable. Bridget wore an old pair of black dress pants and a black silk blouse. She looked like an aging cocktail waitress. She could barely breathe. The food was too precious, the room too stuffy. When the waiter brought out a bottle of champagne after the plates had been cleared, Nora looked around as if the place were bugged. What in God's name? She said. The first time Bridget brought Natalie home, her mother said, Natalie, you have such style. You should take our Bridget shopping.
It occurred to her then that Natalie was the daughter her mother was praying for all those nights when they were kids, the whole family kneeling in front of the sofa, saying the rosary as they listened to Cardinal Cushing on the radio. Nora was forever trying to improve upon Bridget, her criticisms most often wrapped up in what she considered compliments. "You've such a nice face. Why won't you do anything with it?" "To leave those cheekbones bare is a sin against God." "Do you know how pretty you'd look if you'd just tweeze your eyebrows, grow out your hair, put on some lipstick, Bridget? It won't kill you." At the party she threw every year on Christmas Eve, Nora introduced Natalie to cousins and neighbors as Bridget's friend from New York, or else, on a few unfortunate occasions, Bridget's roommate. "Your mother cannot possibly think that at your age you just decided to get a roommate for the hell of it," Natalie had said on one of those nights, tucked into Bridget's childhood bed beside her, an air mattress made up and untouched on the floor. "I think that's what she wants to believe," Bridget said. "So she doesn't know you're gay." "Maybe it has nothing to do with gay. Maybe she just thinks you're way out of my league and can't imagine why you'd live with me other than to go halvesies on the rent." She pulled Natalie into her arms, hoping the joke would smooth over the pain in it. Sometimes Bridget thought Nora knew and chose to ignore it. Her mother had a knack for blocking out what she didn't want to be true. Other times, she thought Nora truly didn't know, even though Bridget had told her. Her sophomore year at UMass, she had sex with a woman for the first time. It happened the night before she went home for Thanksgiving, and it was all Bridget could think about, reliving those moments as she passed the cranberry sauce and watched the Macy's parade on TV and talked about football with her father. She had determined to come out to her mother on that trip. After dinner, while everyone else was napping, and Nora scooped the leftover vegetables into a giant serving tray so that they looked like the Irish flag, a thick stripe of green beans, then mashed potatoes, then squash, Bridget said, "Mom, I have to tell you something. I don't want you to be upset." Nora looked up at her, a spoonful of potatoes suspended midair. "I'm mostly seeing women these days. I think that's where I'm headed." Bridget bit the inside of her cheek as she waited for her mother to react. But Nora's expression was unreadable. "Do you understand?" Bridget asked after a long silence. "Yes," her mother said. "You do?" "Yes." Nora didn't add, "I love you," but she never said that. Bridget couldn't believe it had been so easy. She felt a huge weight lifted from her shoulders, until Christmas, a month later, when Nora said, "Bridget, Tommy Delaney's home. You should go down the hill and see him. Eileen says he still has a thing for you." When she was a freshman in high school, she had tried to date one guy, the only guy who asked, a kid from the neighborhood, the son of her mother's friend. They went out for maybe a month. Nora had never let it go. Bridget looked at her mother with wide eyes. "What?" Nora said. "I'm not saying you should marry him. Just a winter romance might be nice." The morning rushed by, like every morning at the shelter, a haze of routine and surprise. Bridget let in the three kids who were scheduled to volunteer, hosing down crates, filling water bowls, walking dogs. She only ever hired boys who were scrappy and strong, but sweet. Boys who reminded her of her brothers when they were young. She and her assistant director, Michelle, traded off early mornings. Michelle had already been here at 6, and was off now to meet with a prospective donor, the kind of thing Bridget hated to do. They made an ideal pair. Michelle was good at talking to people who loved animals. Bridget was good at talking to the animals themselves. A cacophonous chorus of barks and cries swelled when she opened the door into the back. She greeted all 18 dogs, 9 cats, 2 lizards, by name. This afternoon she would take 3 cane corsos to the vet to be fixed. She regarded them now, feeling sorry for them, for what they didn't know about their own fate. She made a mental note to buy them some sliced turkey from the bodega at the corner, a small consolation. At 9:30, she got a call from a buddy at the police department. A hoarding situation in the Bronx. 39 guinea pigs. Would she take them? Yes, she would take them. She had never turned an animal away if she had the room. He knew this. They all did. That's why they called her first. It wasn't until she was alone in her office just before 10 that Bridget dug her cell phone out of her coat pocket and saw that her mother had called 7 times. John had texted, too. "Call me ASAP." "Oh," she said. "Shit." Bridget held her breath as she dialed. She knew how this went. She had 19 first cousins, 10 aunts and uncles. There were so many of them in the family that when tragedy occurred, instead of being shocked by it, the bigger shock was that somehow all of them managed to make it through so many days and years unscathed. Then you got a phone call, and the world took on a different shape. She braced herself to hear Nora say that some elderly relative had died in her sleep, though she held out hope that this was one of those calls from her mother that had the whiff of somber urgency, but was in fact just a heads up that Macy's was having a white sale. From Nora's hello, the weariness in it, Bridget could tell the news was bad. "Is it Aunt Kitty?" she said, wanting her mother to spit it out, whatever it was. "It's Patrick," Nora said. "Patrick." Bridget's chest felt like it would burst. Never in a million years. Nora was speaking, but to Bridget, the words came through in a blur. "He swerved into a wall. He died on impact. He didn't suffer." Already the consolations. Her legs shook. She leaned against a chair to steady herself, then decided just to let her body slip to the floor. Even as her mother said that the wake would be tomorrow afternoon, with the funeral to follow on Wednesday morning, Bridget's mind grasped for a loophole. It had to be a mistake, a joke. It couldn't be true that there was nothing they could do to save him. Her teeth chattered. Her body was in revolt. "I'll be there in a few hours," she said. "Why don't you come in the morning?" Nora said. "It's not a good idea to drive so far after you've had a shock to the system like this." Her voice was cool, calm, as if she weren't part of the tragedy, just a helpful travel advisor. "Are you sure you want to do the wake so soon?" Bridget said. "You could wait a day or two. Give yourself a chance to..." "I need to get it behind me," Nora said. "I understand. How can I help? What do you need?" "I need to hang up now. I have to go to Patrick's and find his suit." "By yourself?" "Of course." Bridget hesitated, wanting to ask if that was a good idea. "It's nothing," Nora said before she could get the words out. She always acted like an emotion expressed was the most dangerous thing in the world, When Bridget fell down as a child, her mother would pull her to her feet and tell her she was fine, willing it to be so, ignoring whatever pain she might be in, as if not mentioning it would make it just dissolve. In adulthood, the same impulse took on different forms. Her father's death, too, had come out of nowhere, a fast-moving cancer, the reality of which had yet to sink in for any of them by the time Charlie died. Bridget remembered Nora, calmly walking arm in arm with Brian and Patrick into the funeral home, instructing them all not to cry. At home, Bridget tried to pack, but she couldn't seem to remember how. She found herself pulling one item of clothing after another from the drawers, an indiscriminate pile forming on the bed. She wanted to call John, and yet somehow she knew that once she heard his voice, this would be real. So she went and sat on the sofa and stared at the wall instead, the dog lying at her feet. After a while, she got up and made tea, because it was what her people did at times like this. At the last second, she added bourbon instead of milk. Bridget called Natalie twice but couldn't get through. She didn't leave a message. It wasn't the sort of thing you could say on someone's voicemail. And if she was being honest, she wanted to be alone. She would hate for Natalie to come in now and hug her, say that everything would be all right. She was her mother's daughter, she supposed, prickly when she was most in need of love. She pictured Patrick's body on a gurney somewhere. She could not get the image from her mind. Her brother had been a drinker. But then, so were half the people they knew. They were supposed to accept that what he did when he was drinking didn't count. It wasn't real behavior. When he was young, Pat made stupid mistakes all the time. He got into fights. He drove like a maniac. But for the most part, she had thought all that was behind him. Bridget petted Rocco's neck. His white fur was gone in patches, his eyes clouded over with a milky glaze, close to blind. Once he was so strong he could pull her to the ground if she wasn't careful. Now, sometimes, Bridget had to carry him up the 3 flights to the apartment. When John and Julia's daughter Maeve was 6, she was terrified of him. Bridget brought the dog home to Boston one weekend. During a cookout in her parents' backyard, she held Maeve's tiny hand and had her stroke Rocco's back. People sometimes do bad things to dogs like him. But he's sweet, see? It's not his fault. Maeve nodded earnestly. Nora stood by with a wide-eyed expression that said perhaps this was true, but every so often you read about one of these dogs eating a child's face off, and if it happened to her only granddaughter, she would have Bridget killed. Patrick was there, a beer in hand. He laughed. "Calm down, Ma," he said. No one else would dare talk to Nora like that, but Patrick could do no wrong in her eyes. The 4 Rafferty children had their roles. Patrick, the wild one, their mother's favorite. John, the overachiever, their father's favorite. Bridget, the girl, a girl being its own thing, no additional personality traits needed or noticed, except that she was never quite girly enough. Brian, the baby. When he was born, Bridget was 10. Everyone assumed she'd want nothing more than to push Brian around in a stroller all day, pretending he was hers. But Bridget would rather be off, playing at the beach, riding her bike. She was forever bringing wounded animals home, pregnant cats and garter snakes and birds with broken wings. It was Patrick, at 16, who loved Brian most. Bridget imagined herself, John, and Brian in the front pew at St. Anne's in 2 days' time, heads bowed as a priest sprinkled holy water on a wooden box. Patrick inside, when he should be there beside them. Patrick hated priests. When they were younger and went to Mass as a family, Charlie gave them each a dollar for the collection plate. Pat pretended to drop his in the basket, while actually crumpling it into his palm and up his sleeve. He said the priests didn't deserve the money. "They spend it all on booze," he said, "in their beach house. Father Reardon drives a Cadillac. Vow of poverty, my ass. That's what Fergie says." Years later, Patrick told Bridget Moore about what a priest had done to his friend when he was a kid. They were at Patrick's bar, commiserating about the church, the two of them the family's only defectors. Pat gestured to his buddy pouring a beer from the tap. "Fergie went through hell," he said. "His mother didn't do a thing about it. The kid can do no wrong after that, as far as I'm concerned." Pat wouldn't say which priest it was. Fergie had sworn him to secrecy. But Bridget thought she knew. Her brother was kicked out of St. Ignatius Prep at the end of his freshman year for spitting in the face of the principal, Father MacDonald. An episode so astonishing that they were forbidden from ever mentioning it at home. He never went back to church as an adult. But now that he was gone, it was all in Nora's hands. And so, a priest would be the one to usher Patrick from this world. John called just after 2.
"Jesus fucking Christ," he said instead of hello.
"I can't understand it," Bridget said. "I just cannot comprehend.
He drove into a wall and that's it? He's gone?
What happened? Is it possible there was something wrong with the car? Has anyone looked into that?"
"Bridget, he was drinking. He died doing what he loved."
"That's not funny," she said.
"I'm serious. That asshole never cared what he put Mom through, or any of us for that matter. Now we get to pick up the pieces. You can't call a dead person an asshole."
She knew he didn't mean it. This was just how he got. Mad first, and then sad. He would only say it to her. Not to Julia. Never to Nora.
"How are we supposed to explain this to Maeve?" he said. "We're having a family meeting tonight." "Well, we were going to have one anyway, but not on this topic. I'm supposed to be in Chicago right now, and instead I'm dealing with the fact that Mom wants me to give a eulogy for a guy I couldn't stand."
He would do it. John was the one who did things like give eulogies, because Bridget was too awkward, and Brian, much as he worshipped Patrick, would sooner jump in the coffin with him than address a crowd. Bridget and John were born a year apart. They had always gone together, even though they were as different as two people could be. As kids, their conversations could turn from light and meaningless into something charged in an instant. Before anyone noticed what had happened, they'd be down on the kitchen floor wrestling, rolling around, kicking each other until they cried or laughed, or Nora started hitting them with a broom, as if she could sweep away the whole ugly mess. Bridget knew John in a way no one else did. He was rich as Croesus now, with a new McMansion in Weston and a new personality to match. But she could still call him out the same as ever. When they were kids and any of the local politicians shook hands at a parade, John wasn't at all afraid to say, "I want to be like you one day, sir." The eyes on Billy Bulger or Joe Moakley
Even the mayor, Kevin White, would just light up.
Is that right?
They'd say. In this manner, he'd gotten himself tours of the State House, hundreds of buttons and personal letters, visits to his third-grade class. He grew addicted to the attention. Bridget wondered what all those good Irish Democrats thought when John made a fortune helping the other side. She was shocked when he told her over dinner 7 years back that after a decade and a half spent toiling for Democrats, he had taken a great job, a killer job, working for a Republican. Honestly, they're all the same, John said. The older I get, the more I see that. I want to work for the guy who respects me, who will put my talents to use. Bridget didn't say anything. She was thinking that she had read somewhere once that when a person began a sentence with the word honestly, it usually meant he was lying.
It doesn't mean I'm a Republican, John went on. If you work at a shoe store, does it mean you're a shoe?
Bridget nearly choked on her beer.
You did not just make that comparison.
His business was booming now, conservative clients full of optimism, overpaying him, as if the recent election had never occurred. She wondered if, seeing history made, her brother regretted his choice. She wondered what it was about John that allowed him to make it in the first place.
What am I supposed to say about Patrick? John said now. We haven't even spoken in 8 months.
Sometimes Bridget forgot. Her two older brothers were often at war, but they were oddly fine in each other's company. You didn't notice that they never addressed each other directly, unless you looked closely. At family gatherings, everyone was speaking so fast, talking over one another, finishing stories someone else had started, contradicting the endings every time.
That wasn't it. What he said was...
They all laughed before the teller could finish, knowing what was to come. In a good-natured way, almost as terms of endearment, they called each other moron, idiot, simpleton, homo. Words were nothing to them.
How's Brian handling all this? She said. I need to call him.
Don't know. He went AWOL after Mom told him. Just ran straight out of the house, apparently.
Jesus. He must have been with Patrick last night, right? They were probably both working at the bar.
And Brian's probably back there now, John said. I wouldn't worry, though Mom is freaking out about it, of course.
Have you seen her?
Yeah, we're at her house now. Julia and I brought Maeve over. We brought her some lunch, just subs from Victoria's. She doesn't want to eat.
Bridget pictured Nora, despondent at her kitchen table. Talk about when we were young, she said. Nora would like that best.
What?
The eulogy. Tell the old stories. Tell the one about the lobsters. During the blizzard of 78, when all the stores were shut and the power was out, Patrick had walked in out of the snow with an armful of lobsters that had washed up on the beach, his boots dripping water under the kitchen floor. His handsome face, his black hair, that smile. The whole family applauded. They had a feast that night and the next, keeping the lobsters cold out in a snowdrift by the porch. When Natalie finally called her back, she sounded distracted, busy.
Sorry, sweetie, I've been in meetings and I had that lunch with my boss. What's up?
It was like she was calling from some other realm. Meetings and lunches still meant something. Ordinary time hadn't stopped. Part of Bridget wanted to protect her, let her stay there.
When she told her what had happened, Natalie said, "I'm coming straight home." As soon as she walked in the door, she pulled Bridget to her, the smell of the cold still in her hair. Bridget collapsed in her arms, wishing now that she had gotten Natalie there sooner. Natalie rushed into the bedroom without taking off her coat, then popped her head out. "It will take me 5 minutes to pack a bag. Just give me 5 minutes and we'll go." Bridget followed her. "My mother said to drive up in the morning." "But shouldn't we be doing something? Doesn't she need help?" "You know my mother." Nora never trusted anyone but herself to do anything domestic, as if it would dim her power somehow. If she died tomorrow, none of them would have the slightest idea how to cook a roast or where she kept the vacuum. At Christmas a few weeks earlier, Bridget sat at the kitchen table drinking a mimosa as Nora made the gravy. She had thought to herself, "Pay attention, you might need to know how to do this someday." But she hadn't watched. Instead, she wandered into the living room where her brothers were watching football. She sank down into the quicksand of the couch cushions and ate cheese and crackers and onion dip until she felt too full to go near the actual meal and had to be pulled up by Brian and Patrick when Nora called, "Dinner!" Bridget realized now that that was the last time she would ever see Patrick alive. Natalie packed for them both. She ordered Thai food from Bridget's favorite spot, but neither of them ate. They put the TV on, just for background noise, and huddled together on the couch. Over and over again, Bridget had the feeling of forgetting for a moment, and then the terrible recollection of what had happened, where they were. While they sat there, noodles growing cold on the coffee table, her eye kept landing on their bags in the corner. A thought crept in. "I know I promised I'd tell my mother about the baby thing the next time I saw her, but you know I can't tell her now, right?" Bridget said. "Now isn't the time to break the news." "Sure," Natalie said, but then she added, "It's not cancer, you know. It's good news. A baby. It might actually make your mother happy once she has time to get used to the idea. She must want you to be happy. I'm sure when all is said and done, she'd rather you just be honest." Happiness was not a state to which Nora had ever aspired. She had always tried to impress upon her children that she and her cohort had never worried about anything so trivial as whether or not they were happy. And honesty. Bridget wanted to say that this was Nora they were talking about. Nora, who, when the conversation arose about how to talk to Maeve about her adoption, had said to John and Julia, "Why do you have to tell her at all? I had a friend from church with two adopted sons, and they never had an inkling." "Well, Maeve is from China, Mom, so I think she'll have an inkling," John had said. Natalie looked prepared to dig in further now, but then she said, "I get it. I understand." "You do?" "Yes. Take all the time you need. Although, we could just order the sperm so we know we have it." "No," Bridget said. "I should tell her first." Natalie tried to hide her annoyance. "Why?" "I don't know. I just feel like I should." "And you're sure this isn't your way of giving yourself an escape hatch?" "Of course not," Bridget said, when in fact she wasn't sure of it at all. Natalie was her family now, the person she most needed to protect. But Nora. Bridget worried about her, too. She was 73, which wasn't that old anymore. But Nora seemed old.
Bridget had friends whose parents went on bicycle tours of Europe and posted their photos online. Nora refused even to email. She said she was past the point where any of that would make sense to her. A foreign language. What would she make of a baby shared by two women, the father a stranger whose face they had only ever seen in an old childhood photograph posted online? This wasn't a reality Bridget had imagined for herself. She hadn't prepared her mother for it. Natalie didn't understand that Nora's love came with strings, that her faith told her someone like Bridget, like Natalie, was less than, just by virtue of who she was. Their child? What would Nora say about that? In the eyes of the Catholic Church, birth could be a miracle or a sin, depending. Bridget and Natalie were almost a decade apart. It made a difference. Natalie was born into an age of acceptance. She hadn't quite processed that when it came to being gay, Bridget's memories were not those of a gentle sexual awakening at an indulgent women's college, fuzzy heart-to-hearts with one's understanding parents. Repression was the order of the day in her house growing up. Nora and Charlie slept in separate beds. Privately, Bridget and John referred to them as Bert and Ernie. She believed it was entirely possible that they had only had sex four times, each encounter resulting in a child. Every year on her mother's birthday, her father gave her a drugstore greeting card with two words written on it. Her name at the top and his at the bottom. They had never been the type to argue, but Bridget's parents existed in separate worlds. She was certain they had never gazed into each other's eyes, discussing their fears and dreams. Nora, happy birthday. Charlie. Bridget remembered how, for a few years while she was in grade school, there were two women living together in a house at the end of Sydney Street. They kept the lawn up beautifully, planted peonies, and sat on the porch on summer nights like everyone else in the neighborhood. Her parents were friendly with them, said hello. But once, passing by in the car, Charlie said under his breath, "Lesbians." Bridget hadn't heard the word before. She could tell it was something shameful, disgusting. "I thought they were sisters," Nora said, and Charlie threw his head back and laughed. Bridget was 7 at the time, and in love with her best friend Molly Quinn, though she didn't think of it as romantic love particularly. She was just infatuated with Molly. The long brown hair that she let Bridget brush after school, the smell of ivory soap on her skin. When Bridget said once that she was going to marry Molly, Nora looked at her, stricken, and then turned away, pretending it hadn't happened. 2 decades later, on St. Patrick's Day, 1992, Bridget was visiting Boston for the parade and the annual party thrown by her Aunt Babs and Uncle Lawrence, as she did every year. She was 28 years old. That year, a group of out gay people wanted to march. It had caused an uproar, gone all the way to the state Supreme Court. The group was granted access in the end. When they went by, people hurled beer cans and smoke bombs. A huge guy in a white Irish knit sweater held a child wearing a smaller version. Minutes earlier, the guy had been tearing up as he sang "The Unicorn" to his son. Now he screamed, "Quarantine the queers!" Others joined in. An old lady with a green carnation corsage pinned to her coat held a sign that read, "AIDS cures gays." Bridget's relatives weren't the people shouting or throwing rocks.
They were the ones standing across the street from them, doing nothing about it. As a child, Bridget loved the Catholic Church. She was jealous that John got to be an altar boy, that he sometimes got to skip school to work a funeral. Funerals were better than weddings, he said. You got the best tips. Bridget idolized the priests and imagined that she herself might become one someday, though she couldn't say how. But in time, this had changed. When a priest on the news that night said that to allow gays to march was to condone immorality, she couldn't shake her bitterness that this institution that had ruled their lives, these men with all their perversions, stood in judgment of her. That after so many years in their presence, she stood in judgment of herself. Her mother was nodding at the TV. There and then, Bridget vowed that she would never force the issue with her. She wasn't a rebel. Deep down, she wanted to please Nora. She wanted to be known by her, too. But that mattered less. Now, Bridget's life was different. And soon, this would have to change. She couldn't lose Natalie. That was a fear she wouldn't even entertain. But with Patrick gone, her mother shattered, how would she find the words? Patrick had been the first in the family to meet Natalie. They liked each other from the start. They were an unlikely pair. Her brother, still clinging to the Boston tough guy thing, a guy who ran a bar and had never been to college. And Natalie, who graduated from Barnard, who did Pilates 3 times a week, who spoke in the calmest tone, the voice of someone who actually meditated, rather than just thinking about it from time to time. But they got along, bonded over the Red Sox and a shared love of Frank Sinatra. Bridget hadn't introduced them on purpose. On a Friday night in October 2004, when the Red Sox had just won the World Series, she and Natalie got drunk on margaritas at a Mexican restaurant in Midtown. They had only been dating a few months, but already it felt serious. Sometime around 9, Natalie joked that they were so close to Port Authority they should probably jump on a bus up to Boston for the victory parade. By 2 a.m., the joke had turned into a plan. As they sped up 95, the bus full of happy, drunken idiots like them, Bridget thought of how she had never been to Boston without telling her family. There was something liberating about it. They took a long walk at dawn, then went for breakfast. An hour later, coming out of a diner by South Station, they ran smack into Patrick and Brian and their cousins Mattie and Sean. She remembered how the back of her hand was touching the back of Natalie's. The look on Natalie's face when she pulled away. They chatted with the guys who, it turned out, had the same plan in mind. All 5 of them went to a bar by Government Center for early morning beers. When Natalie was in the bathroom, Pat said,
"Awesome girl. Cute, too. Ma know about her?"
"No."
"Have you ever thought of telling her?"
"Patrick, I've thought about it my whole life."
"Tell her, then. Believe me, Bridget, she has secrets of her own worse than that."
Chapter 9. Years ago, Pat hung a clock over the bar, an illuminated glass dome the size of a beach ball. On the hour, the Budweiser Clydesdales marched in a circle around the edge. They mocked him for it at the time.
"What?" Pat said. "The guy gave me a great deal."
And Fergie said,
The only deal that makes sense is if he paid you to take that thing off his hands.
Brian watched now as the Clydesdales made their